Persuasion by Jane Austen. Chapter 1. Sir Walter Elliot of Kellynch Hall in Somersetshire was a man who, for his own amusement, never took up any book but the baronetage. There he found occupation in an idle hour and consolation in a distressed one. There his faculties were roused into admiration and respect by contemplating the limited remnant of the earliest patents. There any unwelcome sensations arising from domestic affairs changed naturally into pity and contempt as he turned over the almost endless creations of the last century. And there, if every other leaf were powerless, he could read his own history with an interest which never failed. This was the page at which the favourite volume always opened. Elliot of Kellynch Hall. Walter Elliot, born March 1, 1760, married July 15, 1784. Elizabeth, daughter of James Stevenson Esquire of South Park in the county of Gloucester, by which lady, who died 1800, he has issue Elizabeth, born June 1, 1785, and born August 9, 1787, a stillborn son, November 5, 1789, Mary, born November 20, 1791. Precisely such had the paragraph originally stood from the printer's hands, but Sir Walter had improved it by adding, for the information of himself and his family, these words after the date of Mary's birth. Married December 16, 1810. Charles, son and heir of Charles Musgrove Esquire of Uppercross in the county of Somerset. And by inserting, most accurately, the day of the month on which he had lost his wife. Then followed the history and rise of the ancient and respectable family in the usual terms, how it had been first settled in Cheshire, how mentioned in Dugdale, serving the office of High Sheriff, representing a borough in three successive parliaments, exertions of loyalty and dignity of baronet in the first year of Charles II, with all the Marys and Elizabeths they had married, forming altogether two handsome duodecimo pages, and concluding with the arms and motto,
Principal Seat, Kellynch Hall, in the county of Somerset.
And Sir Walter's handwriting again in this finale.
Heir presumptive, William Walter Elliot Esquire, great-grandson of the second Sir Walter.
Vanity was the beginning and the end of Sir Walter's character. Vanity of person and of situation. He had been remarkably handsome in his youth, and at 54 was still a very fine man. Few women could think more of their personal appearance than he did, nor could the valet of any new-made lord be more delighted with the place he held in society. He considered the blessing of beauty as inferior only to the blessing of baronetcy, and the Sir Walter Elliot who united these gifts was the constant object of his warmest respect and devotion. His good looks and his rank had one fair claim on his attachment, since to them he must have owed a wife of very superior character to anything deserved by his own. Lady Elliot had been an excellent woman, sensible and amiable, whose judgment and conduct, if they might be pardoned the youthful infatuation which made her Lady Elliot, had never required indulgence afterwards. She had humoured or softened or concealed his failings and promoted his real respectability for 17 years, and though not the happiest being in the world herself, had found enough in her duties, her friends and her children to attach her to life and make it no matter of indifference to her when she was called on to quit them. Three girls, the two eldest, 16 and 14, was an awful legacy for a mother to bequeath, an awful charge, rather, to confide to the authority and guidance of a conceited, silly father. She had, however, one very intimate friend, a sensible, deserving woman who had been brought by strong attachment to herself to settle close by her in the village of Callinch. And on her kindness and advice, Lady Elliot mainly relied for the best help and maintenance of the good principles and instruction which she had been anxiously giving her daughters. This friend and Sir Walter did not marry, whatever had been anticipated on that head by their acquaintance. 13 years had passed away since Lady Elliot's death, and they were still near neighbours and intimate friends, and one remained a widower and the other a widow. That Lady Russell, of steady age and character and extremely well provided for, should have no thought of a second marriage needs no apology to the public, which is rather apt to be unreasonably discontented when a woman does marry again than when she does not. But Sir Walter's continuing in singleness requires explanation. Be it known, then, that Sir Walter, like a good father, having met with one or two private disappointments in very unreasonable applications, prided himself on remaining single for his dear daughter's sake. For one daughter, his eldest, he would really have given up anything which he had not been very much tempted to do. Elizabeth had succeeded at 16 to all that was possible of her mother's rights and consequence, and being very handsome and very like himself, her influence had always been great, and they had gone on together most happily. His two other children were of inferior value. Mary had acquired a little artificial importance by becoming Mrs. Charles Musgrove, but Anne, with an elegance of mind and sweetness of character which must have placed her high with any people of real understanding, was nobody with either father or sister. Her word had no weight. Her convenience was always to give way. She was only Anne. To Lady Russell, indeed, she was a most dear and highly valued goddaughter, favourite, and friend. Lady Russell loved them all, but it was only in Anne that she could fancy the mother to revive again. A few years before, Anne Elliot had been a very pretty girl, but her bloom had vanished early. And as even in its height her father had found little to admire in her, so totally different were her delicate features and mild dark eyes from his own, there could be nothing in them, now that she was faded and thin, to excite his esteem. He had never indulged much hope. He had now none of ever reading her name in any other page of his favourite work. All equality of alliance must rest with Elizabeth, for Mary had merely connected herself with an old country family of respectability and large fortune, and had therefore given all the honour and received none. Elizabeth would, one day or other, marry suitably. It sometimes happens that a woman is handsomer at 29 than she was 10 years before. And generally speaking, if there has been neither ill health nor anxiety, it is a time of life at which scarcely any charm is lost. It was so with Elizabeth, still the same handsome Miss Elliot that she had begun to be 13 years ago. And Sir Walter might be excused, therefore, in forgetting her age, or, at least, be deemed only half a fool for thinking himself and Elizabeth as blooming as ever amidst the wreck of good looks of everybody else. For he could plainly see how old all the rest of his family and acquaintance were growing. Anne haggard, Mary coarse, every face in the neighbourhood worsting, and the rapid increase of crow's feet about Lady Russell's temples had long been a distress to him. Elizabeth did not quite equal her father in personal contentment. 13 years had seen her mistress of Callinch Hall, presiding and directing with a self-possession and decision which could never have given the idea of her being younger than she was. For 13 years she had been doing the honours and laying down the domestic law at home and leading the way to the chaise and four, and walking immediately after Lady Russell out of all the drawing-rooms and dining-rooms in the country. 13 winters' revolving frosts had seen her opening every ball of credit which a scanty neighbourhood afforded, and 13 springs shone their blossoms as she travelled up to London with her father for a few weeks' annual enjoyment of the great world. She had the remembrance of all this. She had the consciousness of being 9 and 20 to give her some regrets and some apprehensions. She was fully satisfied of being still quite as handsome as ever, but she felt her approach to the years of danger and would have rejoiced to be certain of being properly solicited by Baronet Blood within the next 12 months or two. Then might she again take up the Book of Books with as much enjoyment as her early youth, but now she liked it not. Always to be presented with the date of her own birth and see no marriage follow but that of a youngest sister made the book an evil. And more than once, when her father had left it open on the table near her, had she closed it with averted eyes and pushed it away. She had had a disappointment, moreover, which that book, and especially the history of her own family, must ever present the remembrance of. The heir presumptive, the very William Walter Elliot Esquire, whose rights had been so generously supported by her father, had disappointed her. She had, while a very young girl, as soon as she had known him to be, in the event of her having no brother, the future baronet, meant to marry him, and her father had always meant that she should. He had not been known to them as a boy, but soon after Lady Elliot's death, Sir Walter had sought the acquaintance, and though his overtures had not been met with any warmth, he had persevered in seeking it, making allowance for the modest drawing back of youth. And in one of their spring excursions to London when Elizabeth was in her first bloom, Mr. Elliot had been forced into introduction. He was at that time a very young man, just engaged in the study of the law, and Elizabeth found him extremely agreeable, and every plan in his favour was confirmed. He was invited to Kellynch. He was talked of and expected all the rest of the year, but he never came. The following spring, he was seen again in town, found equally agreeable, again encouraged, invited, and expected, and again. He did not come. And the next tidings were that he was married. Instead of pushing his fortune in the line marked out for the heir of the House of Elliot, he had purchased independence by uniting himself to a rich woman of inferior birth. Sir Walter had resented it. As the head of the house, he felt that he ought to have been consulted, especially after taking the young man so publicly by the hand.
For we must have been seen together, once at Tattersall's and twice in the lobby of the House of Commons.
His disapprobation was expressed, but apparently very little regarded. Mr. Elliot had attempted no apology and shown himself as unsolicitous of being longer noticed by the family as Sir Walter considered him unworthy of it. All acquaintance between them had ceased. This very awkward history of Mr. Elliot was still, after an interval of several years, felt with anger by Elizabeth, who had liked him for the man himself, and still more for being her father's heir, and whose strong family pride could see only in him a proper match for Sir Walter Elliot's eldest daughter. There was not a baronet from A to Z whom her feelings could have so willingly acknowledged as equal. Yet so miserably had he conducted himself that, though she was at this present time, the summer of 1814, wearing black ribbons for his wife, she could not admit him of being worth thinking of again. The disgrace of his first marriage might perhaps, as there was no reason to suppose it perpetuated by offspring, have been got over, had he not done worse. But he had, as by the customary intervention of kind friends they had been informed, spoken most disrespectfully of them all, most slightingly and contemptuously of the very blood he belonged to and the honours which were hereafter to be his own. This could not be pardoned. Such were Elizabeth Elliot's sentiments and sensations. such the cares to alloy, the agitations to vary, the sameness and the elegance, the prosperity and the nothingness of her scene of life, such the feelings to give interest to a long, uneventful residence in one country circle, to fill the vacancies which there were no habits of utility abroad, no talents or accomplishments for home to occupy. But now, another occupation and solicitude of mind was beginning to be added to these. Her father was growing distressed for money. She knew that when he now took up the baronetage, it was to drive the heavy bills of his tradespeople and the unwelcome hints of Mr. Shepherd, his agent, from his thoughts. The Kalinch property was good, but not equal to Sir Walter's apprehension of the state required in its possessor. While Lady Elliot lived, there had been method, moderation, and economy, which had just kept him within his income. But with her had died all such right-mindedness, and from that period he had been constantly exceeding it. It had not been possible for him to spend less. He had done nothing but what Sir Walter Elliot was imperiously called on to do. But blameless as he was, he was not only growing dreadfully in debt, but was hearing of it so often that it became vain to attempt concealing it longer, even partially from his daughter. He had given her some hints of it the last spring in town. He had gone so far, even, as to say,
"Can we retrench? Does it occur to you that there is any one article in which we can retrench?"
And Elizabeth, to do her justice, had, in the first ardour of female alarm, set seriously to think what could be done, and had finally proposed these two branches of economy: to cut off some unnecessary charities, and to refrain from new furnishing the drawing room. To which expedients she afterwards added the happy thought of their taking no present down to Anne, as had been the usual yearly custom. But these measures, however good in themselves, were insufficient for the real extent of the evil, the whole of which Sir Walter found himself obliged to confess to her soon afterwards. Elizabeth had nothing to propose of deeper efficacy. She felt herself ill-used and unfortunate, as did her father, and they were neither of them able to devise any means of lessening their expenses without compromising their dignity or relinquishing their comforts in a way not to be borne. There was only a small part of his estate that Sir Walter could dispose of, but had every acre been alienable, it would have made no difference. He had condescended to mortgage as far as he had the power, but he would never concede to sell. No, no, he would never disgrace his name so far. The Kalinch estate should be transmitted whole and entire as he had received it. Their two confidential friends, Mr. Shepherd, who lived in the neighbouring market town, and Lady Russell, were called on to advise them. And both father and daughter seemed to expect that something should be struck out by one or the other to remove their embarrassments and reduce their expenditure without involving the loss of any indulgence of taste or pride. Chapter 2. Mr. Shepherd, a civil, cautious lawyer who, whatever might be his hold or his views on Sir Walter, would rather have the disagreeable prompted by anybody else, excused himself from offering the slightest hint, and only begged leave to recommend an implicit reference to the excellent judgment of Lady Russell, from whose known good sense he fully expected to have just such resolute measures advised as he meant to see finally adopted. Lady Russell was most anxiously zealous on the subject and gave it much serious consideration. She was a woman rather of sound than of quick abilities, whose difficulties in coming to any decision in this instance were great from the opposition of two leading principles. She was of strict integrity herself with a delicate sense of honour, but she was as desirous of saving Sir Walter's feelings, as solicitous for the credit of the family, as aristocratic in her ideas of what was due to them, as anybody of sense and honesty could well be. She was a benevolent, charitable, good woman, and capable of strong attachments. and with manners that showed a standard of good breeding. She had a cultivated mind and was, generally speaking, rational and consistent, but she had prejudices on the side of ancestry. She had a value for rank and consequence, which blinded her a little to the faults of those who possessed them. Herself the widow of only a knight, she gave the dignity of a baronet all its due. And Sir Walter, independent of his claims as an old acquaintance, an attentive neighbour, an obliging landlord, the husband of her very dear friend, the father of Anne and her sisters, was, as being Sir Walter, in her apprehension, entitled to a great deal of compassion and consideration under his present difficulties. They must retrench. That did not admit of a doubt. But she was very anxious to have it done with the least possible pain to him and Elizabeth. She drew up plans of economy. She made exact calculations. And she did what nobody else thought of doing. She consulted Anne, who never seemed considered by the others as having any interest in the question. She consulted, and in a degree was influenced by her, in marking out the scheme of retrenchment which was at last submitted to Sir Walter. Every emendation of Anne's had been on the side of honesty against importance. She wanted more vigorous measures, a more complete reformation, a quicker release from debt, a much higher indifference of tone for everything but justice and equity. Looking over her paper, Lady Russell said,
"If we can persuade your father to all this, much may be done. If he will adopt these regulations, in 7 years he will be clear, and I hope we may be able to convince him and Elizabeth that Kellynch Hall has a respectability in itself which cannot be affected by these reductions, and that the true dignity of Sir Walter Elliot will be very far from lessened in the eyes of sensible people by acting like a man of principle. What will he be doing, in fact, but what very many of our first families have done, or ought to do? There will be nothing singular in his case, and it is singularity which often makes the worst part of our suffering, as it always does of our conduct. I have great hope of prevailing. We must be serious and decided, for after all, the person who has contracted debts must pay them, and though a great deal is due to the feelings of the gentleman, and the head of a house like your father, there is still more due to the character of an honest man."
This was the principle on which Anne wanted her father to be proceeding, his friends to be urging him. She considered it as an act of indispensable duty to clear away the claims of creditors with all the expedition which the most comprehensive retrenchments could secure, and saw no dignity in anything short of it. She wanted it to be prescribed and felt as a duty. She rated Lady Russell's influence highly, and as to the severe degree of self-denial which her own conscience prompted, she believed there might be little more difficulty in persuading them to a complete than to half a reformation. Her knowledge of her father and Elizabeth inclined her to think that the sacrifice of one pair of horses would be hardly less painful than of both, and so on, through the whole list of Lady Russell's two gentle reductions. How Anne's more rigid requisitions might have been taken is of little consequence. Lady Russell's had no success at all, could not be put up with, were not to be borne.
What? Every comfort of life knocked off. Journeys, London, servants, horses, table, contractions and restrictions everywhere. To live no longer with the decencies even of a private gentleman. I would sooner quit Kellynch Hall at once than remain in it on such disgraceful terms.
Quit Kellynch Hall. The hint was immediately taken up by Mr. Shepherd, whose interest was involved in the reality of Sir Walter's retrenching, and who was perfectly persuaded that nothing would be done without a change of abode.
Quit Kellynch Hall?
Since the idea had been started in the very quarter which ought to dictate, he had no scruple in confessing his judgment to be entirely on that side. It did not appear to him that Sir Walter could materially alter his style of living in a house which had such a character of hospitality and ancient dignity to support. In any other place, Sir Walter might judge for himself and would be looked up to as regulating the modes of life in whatever way he might choose to model his household. Sir Walter would quit Kellynch Hall, and after a few days more of doubt and indecision, the great question of whither he should go was settled, and the first outline of this important change made out. There had been three alternatives: London, Bath, or another house in the country. All Anne's wishes had been for the latter. A small house in their own neighbourhood, where they might still have Lady Russell's society, still be near Mary, and still have the pleasure of sometimes seeing the lawns and groves of Kellynch, was the object of her ambition. But the usual fate of Anne attended her, in having something very opposite from her inclination fixed on. She disliked Bath, and did not think it agreed with her, and Bath was to be her home. Sir Walter had at first thought more of London, but Mr. Shepherd felt that he could not be trusted in London and had been skilful enough to dissuade him from it and make Bath preferred. It was a much safer place for a gentleman in his predicament. He might there be important at comparatively little expense. Two material advantages of Bath over London had, of course, been given all their weight. Its more convenient distance from Kellynch, only 50 miles, and Lady Russell's spending some part of every winter there. And to the very great satisfaction of Lady Russell, whose first views on the projected change had been for Bath, Sir Walter and Elizabeth were induced to believe that they should lose neither consequence nor enjoyment by settling there. Lady Russell felt obliged to oppose her dear Anne's known wishes. It would be too much to expect Sir Walter to descend into a small house in his own neighbourhood. Anne herself would have found the mortification of it more than she foresaw, and to Sir Walter's feelings, they must have been dreadful. And with regard to Anne's dislike of Bath, she considered it as a prejudice and mistake, first arising from the circumstance of her having been 3 years at school there after her mother's death, and secondly, from her happening to not be in perfectly good spirits the only winter which she afterwards spent there with Lady Russell herself. Lady Russell was fond of Bath, in short, and disposed to think it must suit them all. And as to her young friend's health, by passing all the warm months with her at Kellynch Lodge, every danger would be avoided, and it was in fact a change which must do both health and spirits good. Anne had been too little from home, too little seen. Her spirits were not high. A larger society would improve them. She wanted her to be more known. The undesirableness of any other house in the neighbourhood for Sir Walter was certainly much strengthened by one part, and a very material part of the scheme, which had been happily engrafted on the beginning. He was not only to quit his home, but to see it in the hands of others, a trial of fortitude which stronger heads than Sir Walter's had found too much. Kellynch Hall was to be let. This, however, was a profound secret not to be breathed beyond their own circle. Sir Walter could not have borne the degradation of being known to design letting his house. Mr. Shepherd had once mentioned the word advertise, but never dared approach it again. Sir Walter spurned the idea of its being offered in any manner, forbade the slightest hint being dropped of his having such an intention, and it was only on the supposition of his being spontaneously solicited by some most unexceptional applicant on his own terms and as a great favour that he would let it at all. How quick come the reasons for approving what we like. Lady Russell had another excellent one at hand for being extremely glad that Sir Walter and his family were to remove from the country. Elizabeth had been lately forming an intimacy which she wished to see interrupted. It was with the daughter of Mr. Shepherd, who had returned after an unprosperous marriage to her father's house with the additional burden of two children. She was a very clever young woman who understood the art of pleasing, the art of pleasing at least, at Kellynch Hall, and who had made herself so acceptable to Miss Elliot as to have been already staying there more than once, in spite of all that Lady Russell, who thought it a friendship quite out of place, could hint of caution and reserve. Lady Russell, indeed, had scarcely any influence with Elizabeth, and seemed to love her rather because she would love her than because Elizabeth deserved it. She had never received from her more than outward attention, nothing beyond the observances of complaisance, had never succeeded in any point which she wanted to carry against previous inclination. She had been repeatedly very earnest in trying to get Anne included in the visit to London, sensibly open to all the injustice and all the discredit of the selfish arrangements which shut her out, and on many lesser occasions had endeavoured to give Elizabeth the advantage of her own better judgment and experience, but always in vain. Elizabeth would go her own way, and never had she pursued it in more decided opposition to Lady Russell than in this selection of Mrs. Clay, turning from the society of so deserving a sister to bestow her affection and confidence on one who ought to have been nothing to her but the object of distant civility. From situation, Mrs. Clay was, in Lady Russell's estimate, a very unequal, and in her character she believed a very dangerous companion, and a removal that would leave Mrs. Clay behind and bring a choice of more suitable intimates within Miss Elliot's reach was therefore an object of first-rate importance. Chapter 3. One morning at Kellynch Hall, as he laid down his newspaper, Mr. Shepherd said,
I must take leave to observe, Sir Walter, that the present juncture is much in our favour. This peace will be turning all our rich naval officers ashore. They will be all wanting a home. Could not be a better time, Sir Walter, for having a choice of tenants. Very responsible tenants. Many a noble fortune has been made during the war. If a rich admiral were to come in our way, Sir Walter...
He would be a very lucky man, Shepherd, that's all I have to remark. A prize indeed would Kellynch Hall be to him. Rather, the greatest prize of all. Let him have taken ever so many before. Hey, Shepherd?
Mr. Shepherd laughed, as he knew he must, at this wit, and then added...
I presume to observe, Sir Walter, that in the way of business, gentlemen of the Navy are well to deal with. I have had a little knowledge of their methods of doing business, and I am free to confess that they have very liberal notions, and are as likely to make desirable tenants as any set of people one should meet with. Therefore, Sir Walter, what I would take leave to suggest is that if in consequence of any rumours getting abroad of your intention, which must be contemplated as a possible thing, because we know how difficult it is to keep the actions and designs of one part of the world from the notice and curiosity of the other. Consequence has its tax. I, John Shepherd, might conceal any family matters that I chose, for nobody would think it worth their while to observe me. But Sir Walter Elliot has eyes upon him which it may be very difficult to elude, and therefore thus much I venture upon, that it will not greatly surprise me if, with all our caution, some rumour of the truth should get abroad, in the supposition of which, as I was going to observe, since applications will unquestionably follow, I should think any from our wealthy naval commanders particularly worth attending to, and beg leave to add that 2 hours will bring me over at any time to save you the trouble of replying.
Sir Walter only nodded. But soon afterwards, rising and pacing the room, he observed sarcastically,
There are few among the gentlemen of the Navy, I imagine, who would not be surprised to find themselves in a house of this description.
They would look around them, no doubt, and bless their good fortune,
said Mrs. Clay, for Mrs. Clay was present. Her father had driven her over, nothing being of so much use to Mrs. Clay's health as a drive to Kellynch.
But I quite agree with my father in thinking, A sailor might be a very desirable tenant. I have known a good deal of the profession. And besides their liberality, they are so neat and careful in all their ways. These valuable pictures of yours, Sir Walter, if you should choose to leave them, would be perfectly safe. Everything in and about the house would be taken such excellent care of. The gardens and shrubberies would be kept in almost as high order as they are now. You need not be afraid, Miss Elliot, of your own sweet flower gardens being neglected.
As to all that, supposing I were induced to let my house, I had by no means made up my mind as to the privileges to be annexed to it. I'm not particularly disposed to favour a tenant. The park would be open to him, of course, and few Navy officers or men of any other description can have had such a range, but what restrictions I might impose on the use of the pleasure grounds is another thing. I'm not fond of the idea of my shrubberies being always approachable. And I should recommend Miss Elliot to be on her guard with respect to her flower garden. I am very little disposed to grant a tenant of Kellynch Hall any extraordinary favour, I assure you, be he sailor or soldier.
After a short pause, Mr. Shepherd presumed to say,
"In all these cases, there are established usages which make everything plain and easy between landlord and tenant. Your interest, Sir Walter, is in pretty safe hands. Depend upon me for taking care that no tenant has more than his just rights. I venture to hint that Sir Walter Elliot cannot be half so jealous for his own as John Shepherd will be for him."
Here Anne spoke.
"The Navy, I think, who have done so much for us, have at least an equal claim with any other set of men for all the comforts and all the privileges which any home can give. Sailors work hard enough for their comforts, we must all allow."
"Very true, very true."
"Certainly.
What Miss Anne says is very true."
But Sir Walter's remark was soon afterwards,
"The profession has its utility, but I should be sorry to see any friend of mine belonging to it."
"Indeed."
"Yes. It is in two points offensive to me. I have two strong grounds of objection to it. First, as being the means of bringing persons of obscure birth into undue distinction, and raising men to honours which their fathers and grandfathers never dreamt of. And secondly, as it cuts up a man's youth and vigour most horribly. A sailor grows old sooner than any other man. I have observed it all my life. A man is in greater danger in the Navy of being insulted by the rise of one whose father, his father, might have disdained to speak to, and of becoming prematurely an object of disgust himself than in any other line. One day last spring in town, I was in company with two men, striking instances of what I am talking of. Lord St. Ives, whose father we all know to have been a country curate, without bread to eat. I was to give place to Lord St. Ives, and a certain Admiral Baldwin, the most deplorable-looking personage you can imagine, his face the colour of mahogany, rough and rugged to the last degree, all lines and wrinkles, 9 grey hairs of a side, and nothing but a dab of powder at top. In the name of heaven, who is that old fellow?" said I to a friend of mine who was standing near, Sir Basil Morley. "Old fellow," cried Sir Basil, "it is Admiral Baldwin. What do you take his age to be?" 60, said I, "or perhaps 62. 40, replied Sir Basil, 40 and no more. Picture to yourselves my amazement. I shall not easily forget Admiral Baldwin. I never saw quite so wretched an example of what a seafaring life can do. Oh, but to a degree, I know it is the same with them all. They are all knocked about and exposed to every climate and every weather till they're not fit to be seen. It is a pity they are not knocked on the head at once before they reach Admiral Baldwin's age.
Nay, Sir Walter, this is being severe indeed. Have a little mercy on the poor men. We are not all born to be handsome. The sea is no beautifier, certainly. Sailors do grow old betimes. I have observed it. They soon lose the look of youth. But then, is it not the same in many other professions? Perhaps most other. Soldiers in active service are not at all better off. And even in the quieter professions, there is a toil and a labour of the mind, if not of the body, which seldom leaves a man's looks to the natural effect of time. The lawyer plods, quite careworn. The physician is up at all hours, and travelling in all weather. And even the clergyman, you know, is obliged to go into infected rooms and expose his health and looks to all the injury of a poisonous atmosphere. In fact, as I have long been convinced, though every profession is necessary and honourable in its turn, it is only the lot of those who are not obliged to follow any, who can live in any regular way, in the country, choosing their own hours, following their own pursuits, and living on their own property, without the torment of trying for more. It is only their lot, I say, to hold the blessings of health and a good appearance to the utmost. I know of no other set of men but what lose something of their personableness when they cease to be quite young.
It seemed as if Mr. Shepherd, in this anxiety to bespeak Sir Walter's goodwill towards a naval officer as tenant, had been gifted with foresight. For the very first application for the house was from an Admiral Croft, with whom he shortly afterwards fell into company in attending the quarter sessions at Taunton. And indeed, he had received a hint of the Admiral from a London correspondent. By the report which he hastened over to Kellynch to make, Admiral Croft was a native of Somersetshire, who, having acquired a very handsome fortune, was wishing to settle in his own country, and had come down to Taunton in order to look at some advertised places in that immediate neighbourhood, which, however, had not suited him. That accidentally hearing, it was just as he had foretold, Mr. Shepherd observed, Sir Walter's concerns could not be kept a secret, accidentally hearing of the possibility of Kellynch Hall being let, and understanding his, Mr. Shepherd's, connection with the owner, he had introduced himself in order to make particular inquiries and had, in the course of a pretty long conference, expressed as strong an inclination for the place as a man who knew it only by description could feel. And given Mr. Shepherd, in his explicit account of himself, every proof of his being a most responsible, eligible tenant.
And who is Admiral Croft?
Mr. Shepherd answered for his being of a gentleman's family, and mentioned a place, and Anne, after a little pause which followed, added,
"He is a Rear Admiral of the White. He was in the Trafalgar action, and has been in the East Indies since. He was stationed there, I believe, several years."
"Then I take it for granted that his face is about as orange as the cuffs and capes of my livery."
"I assure you that Admiral Croft was a very hale, hearty, well-looking man, a little weather-beaten, to be sure, but not much, and quite the gentleman in all his notions and behaviour. Not likely to make the smallest difficulty about terms. Only wanted a comfortable home, and to get into it as soon as possible. Knew he must pay for his convenience, knew what rent a ready-furnished house of that consequence might fetch, should not have been surprised if Sir Walter had asked more. Had inquired about the manor, would be glad of the deputation, certainly, but made no great point of it. Said he sometimes took out a gun, but never killed. Quite the gentleman."
Mr. Shepherd was eloquent on the subject, pointing out all the circumstances of the Admiral's family which made him peculiarly desirable as a tenant. He was a married man, and without children, the very state to be wished for.
A house is never taken good care of without a lady. I do not know whether furniture might not be in danger of suffering as much where there was no lady as where there were many children. A lady without a family is the very best preserver of furniture in the world. I have seen Mrs. Croft, too. She was at Taunton with the Admiral, and had been present almost all the time they were talking the matter over, and a very well-spoken, genteel, shrewd lady she seemed to be. Asked more questions about the house and terms and taxes than the Admiral himself, and seemed more conversant with business. And moreover, Sir Walter, I found she was not quite unconnected in this country, any more than her husband. That is to say, she is sister to a gentleman who did live amongst us once. She told me so herself. Sister to the gentleman who lived a few years back at Monkford. Bless me, what was his name? At this moment, I cannot recollect his name, though I've heard it so lately. Penelope, my dear, can you help me to the name of the gentleman who lived at Monkford, Mrs. Croft's brother?
But Mrs. Clay was talking so eagerly with Miss Elliot that she did not hear the appeal.
I have no conception whom you can mean, Shepherd. I remember no gentleman resident at Monkford since the time of old Governor Twint.
Bless me, how very odd. I shall forget my own name soon, I suppose. A name that I am so very well acquainted with. Knew the gentleman so well by sight. Seen him 100 times. Came to consult me once, I remember, about a trespass of one of his neighbours. Farmer's man breaking into his orchard. Wall torn down. Apples stolen. Caught in the fact. And afterwards, contrary to my judgment, submitted to an amicable compromise. Very odd indeed.
After waiting another moment, Anne said,
"You mean Mr. Wentworth, I suppose?"
Wentworth was the very name. Mr. Wentworth was the very man.
Mr. Shepherd was all gratitude.
He had the curacy of Monkford, you know, Sir Walter, some time back, for 2 or 3 years. Came there about the year 1805, I take it. You remember him, I'm sure.
Wentworth? Oh, aye, Mr. Wentworth, the curate of Monkford. You misled me by the term gentleman. I thought you were speaking of some man of property. Mr. Wentworth was, well, nobody. I remember, quite unconnected, nothing to do with the Strafford family. One wonders how the names of many of our nobility become so common.
As Mr. Shepherd perceived that this connection of the Crofts did them no service with Sir Walter, he mentioned it no more, returning, with all his zeal, to dwell on the circumstances more indisputably in their favour, their age and number and fortune, the high idea they had formed of Kellynch Hall, and extreme solicitude for the advantage of renting it, making it appear as if they ranked nothing beyond the happiness of being the tenants of Sir Walter Elliot. An extraordinary taste, certainly, could they have been supposed in the secret of Sir Walter's estimate of the dues of a tenant. It succeeded, however, and though Sir Walter must ever look with an evil eye on anyone intending to inhabit that house, and think them infinitely too well off in being permitted to rent it on the highest terms, he was talked into allowing Mr. Shepherd to proceed in the treaty, and authorising him to wait on Admiral Croft, who still remained at Taunton, and fix a day for the house being seen. Sir Walter was not very wise, but he still had experience enough of the world to feel that a more unobjectionable tenant, in all essentials than Admiral Croft bid fair to be, could hardly offer. So far went his understanding, and his vanity supplied a little additional soothing in the Admiral's situation in life, which was just high enough and not too high. "I have let my house to Admiral Croft," would sound extremely well, very much better than to any mere Mr. A Mr., save perhaps some half dozen in the nation, always needs a note of explanation. An admiral speaks his own consequence, and at the same time can never make a baronet look small. In all their dealings and intercourse, Sir Walter Elliot must have the precedence. Nothing could be done without a reference to Elizabeth, but her inclination was growing so strong for a removal that she was happy to have it fixed and expedited by a tenant at hand, and not a word to suspend decision was uttered by her. Mr. Shepherd was completely empowered to act, and no sooner had such an end been reached than Anne, who had been a most attentive listener to the whole, left the room to seek comfort of cool air for her flushed cheeks as she walked along a favourite grove, said with a gentle sigh,
"A few months more and he, perhaps, may be walking here."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Ballarat National Theatre's adaptation of Jane Austen's Persuasion and will join us each week until all the episodes have been released. This production is directed and narrated by Liana Emerson, with Sarah Barlow as Assistant Director for Sound Design and Composition. This episode features the voices of Nicholas Barker-Pendry as Sir Walter, Miriam Wood as Lady Russell, Fred Preston as Mr. Shepherd, Jodie Mattingly as Mrs. Clay, Helen Gibson as Elizabeth, and Alex Roberts as Anne Elliott. This podcast features original compositions within the chapters by Sarah Barlow, Liana Emerson, and Helen Gibson that have been mastered by Charlie Hughes. This podcast was produced by Ballarat National Theatre on the lands of our traditional custodians, the Wadawurrung people. Further sound production and cast recordings were made in the lands of the Wadawurrung, Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nation and the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Ballarat National Theatre acknowledges and pays respect to our traditional custodians and to their leaders, past and present. This podcast was made possible because of the financial contributions of the following patrons: Aparajita Ray Chaudhry, Josh Illichman, Elaine So, Tessa Braun, Sean Rundell, Brianna Cook, Shally Barnes, Sean-Chan Nguyen, Sue Skews, Sarah McGregor, Lynn Gibbs, and Rod Skews. Thank you from the director for supporting access to technology that allowed this podcast to be made. This podcast was possible because of collaborative support for recording and music performance from Ballarat Grammar Academy Sound and Performance. It is also supported by grant funding from the City of Ballarat. Now, I know some of you are waiting for the outro stuff to get weird, but there are people who will not have heard about the outros before, so we just have to rein in the weirdness, get them comfortable, and we'll bring that in later on, okay? So just keep that to ourselves. In the meantime, here's some bloopers.
But her inclination was growing so strong for her removal. Her inclination was growing so strong for...
My script is jammed. I've got the spinning beach. Boom, 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 boom. Why is it thinking so hard? I just want to scroll down to the next page. Microphone's in an awkward position, so I'm in an awkward position. I'm like squatting around the thing. It's not a good time. It's not a good time. My back's getting a little bit sore. Spinning beach ball. What is going on? I don't want all the things to be doing their things. Oh, we've scrolled several pages. It's made up for its enthusiasm. There we go. Narrator 11.